Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of No Acronyms Allowed from the Florida Association of Community Health Centers. Today, we're talking with Gary Campbell, who is the CEO of Johnson Health Center in Virginia. Gary is a remarkable leader with a clear passion for community health, the workforce, and making lasting change. We talk with him about his vast experience in the healthcare industry and how he's helping organizations like community health centers position themselves for long-term impact and success. Join us for a great chat with Gary Campbell. So Gary, you know, it's awkward when we talk to people that we know. I mean, I can't say that we know you super, super well, but we've spent enough time together talking about stuff that it's kind of awkward to say, well, who are you? Tell us about you, because we kind of already did that. But I will say, Sheila and I said pretty quickly after we met you, Gary would be really good on this podcast because of how you just had one of those personalities that, like, all right, let's just listen to him talk. Right? It's going to be good wherever it goes. But for those that don't know you, I imagine most of our listeners, since most of them are going to be here in Florida, who are you, Gary?
Well, thank you for asking, Stephen. I appreciate that. And first of all, I'm humbled and certainly honored to be part of the podcast here. And just the short time I've gotten to spend with you both and with the great people at the association has been very rewarding to me. And I don't think I can equate the degree of appreciation that I felt for that. So thank you for that. Gary Campbell, I am born and raised here in Lynchburg, Virginia, and was here most of my younger adult life and left when I was in my mid-30s for Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I really got to cut my teeth on some global exposure. And I didn't move into the health center space until 2011, but my journey took me into places like Ericsson and Babcock and Wilcox, which, you know, they're all over the place, but the Lynchburg, Virginia had a, now they're called BWXT, but you know, I spent time there. That's why I broke into HR. It was my first role. And then kind of migrated from there and went to work for a company called Belcan out of Cincinnati, where I was on site at Ericsson and learned the whole software and cellular phone business and radio systems before making a big move to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1997 when I went to work at Bayer. And Bayer is really where I can credit with getting a lot of my global exposure and learning a lot of things that happen across not only the United States, but in North America, but across the whole world, and got exposure to Germany and host of other countries. But it taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about culture. Taught me a lot about, you know, that things do happen beyond my localized Virginia walls. And so to kind of shorten the story, but in 2011, I made my way back to Lynchburg, Virginia, and went to work for Johnson Health Center as a director of human resources and learned what an FQHC was, because I didn't even know what it stood for. The goal there was to get back to Virginia, because all three of my kids were going to college here in Lynchburg, Virginia. And my wife made a joke one day. She goes, I can work from home and, you'd have to sleep on the couch up here if you decide to stay. And we just laughed about it. But that's what got me into Johnson Health Center. And it's what got me into the FQHC space. We were much, much smaller back then. But I've been here 13 years now. And that's a shocking part. And, you know, being not only a health center, now I'm a health center CEO, I've been a health center CEO now for 10 years, but part of what led me on the journey was the experience and the mentors and the people I got to work with. But, you know, when I first joined the health center, I didn't want to stay here. I just didn't, you know, I really wasn't sure this would be it for me. It was small. Didn't understand it as well. But as I stayed and got to know the people and the people we served and what I was being introduced to and the reality of being able to make an impact, a real impact in a place like this was something I always wanted to do. And So I launched my Impact to Lead back in 2013, which is how I work with you guys and a host of PCAs and health centers all over the country, and in addition to other organizations. But primarily, I spend most of my time in the FQHC space. But it was sort of built on the book that I read called The Go-Giver by David Mann and Bob Berg, and sort of orchestrating my value system around their value system and kind of tying it all together. And then building the Impact to Lead model and dropping it into the health center that I had the certainly the good fortune to run in 2014. And rest is kind of history with that. We've been able to make a we've made so many strides of improvement. I mean, the things that we've been able to do here and becoming an employer of choice, and being named a great place to work multiple times. And we just recently, yesterday, we got notice that we were the first health center in Virginia to get the ACE Award from NAC on the advocacy piece. So
Wow, congrats.
I
we've
did
built.
hear that. I did hear that. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much for that. So just, a lot of this, we were nonprofit of the year last year, but a lot of the things are really the result of just orchestrating our leadership around a set of core values and driving a mission vision and really kind of living and breathing your strategic plan. And so, but it's really enabling people to do the work they do. But that's me. And you asked me who I was. I was a long, who am I? But
Oh,
that's
I say,
me. I've done it
I was
all.
like,
I've done all
Gary,
that stuff.
just check, check, check. Okay,
Podcast is
we're
over.
done.
But I do get to
So
speak. I do all this stuff all over the country. And this is how I got to meet you guys. And it's just so much fun.
So it's really interesting to me because, I say to my colleagues here at the association a lot, if I was here 10 years ago, where I'm at in my career, I'd be a very different colleague than I am today. And some of that is just scar tissue that you just sort of matured through and grew. But I really, and I'm glad that it progressed this way, but I really started out my career. I was always the youngest guy in the room. And I was oftentimes in positions where I should not have been. Now, I was really good at sort of faking it till I could make it, right? But then would kind of go back to the office and be like, okay, now what do I do? And sort of figure it out, right? But I had this whole approach that like my career and legacy, even at 25, I was thinking this was all about being big, right? Like everything I was working to, it needed to have big, huge impact. And there's a lot of ego wrapped up in that, and just all that stuff that like, you get put in enough of those big positions early on, you start buying into it. Luckily, the universe said, hang on there, because you're getting a little too big for your britches. So I say all that to say I had a really, really solid, meaningful transformation, probably about 6 or 7 years ago, where I finally just came to understand, like, I don't care the size of my impact. I care about the quality of my impact, right? And that like one or two people at a time, if it's real impact, perfect. And so I say all that to sort of parallel with your journey of big companies, internationally known companies, traveling and learning and being a player throughout the world, and then bringing it back home on a very local level with the community health center, and which are the anchors within our communities, right? On so many different facets. Does that ring true for you that like it was big, 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 and then now it's local, but does the impact still feel as great that you're having now?
It does, it's and that's a great way to frame it. I hadn't thought about this in a long time, but when I first got back to Lynchburg, Virginia from working at Bayer, I was a younger man back then. And you're right, you do mature with age, and you learn to appreciate things with age, and you learn to an experience, and you learn that there's a much that you're not the only person in the room, nor should you ever be. But I came back with this big big company mentality and said, all right, how do we, you know, I'm going to come in and, you know, get have the opportunity at some point and turn our health center around. But I had to do it in a way that was more locally aligned than taking the global sort of the shareholder approach to it, because,
right,
you know, and that was really what I had to adjust to, is that I had to adjust to a whole different climate of, you know, sort of a workforce climate versus the workforce climate I was exposed to at a larger company. And I'd worked, again, I had worked with large companies my whole career. But what I quickly learned is that, and, you know, I always tell, I get, you know, that I get to do training, I get to do coaching and executive things and all those kind of things. But what I always say is that I tend to learn more from the ones I'm working with than the ones that think they're getting it from me, because I truly learn a lot. And I learned a lot in those early days in particular. The folks that really had brought me in and kind of put me under their wing a little bit, and recognizing that I came from a much larger place, but knowing that I was in a much different place now. And they certainly saw the good in what they figured I could bring. They just needed to see, hey, can he bring it here? And I think that was it. It was narrowing down that impact to be the local feel, trying to impact the community in a way that it changed the face of our credibility in our community, because we were not the most recognizable, but even reputable health centers in our area. And I said, we got to change that, but we have to change it inside first. And it was changing with the people and building the trust with people and helping them unleash their own potential, because they're the ones that change it for you. But right. It was feeling it. And it was, I guess the first thing I learned in my first couple of years here, especially when I got drug into a couple of the exam rooms with providers, because I had a pretty good way of talking with people. And we had some new, I remember one in particular, we had a nurse practitioner who hadn't been with us long. And this has been 11 years ago, before I was a CEO. I was the chief operations officer at the time. And she was struggling with it was two patients. It was a patient. It was a 16-year-old. And her grandmother had brought her to get some pretty immediate care that needed to happen. And the granddaughter was not cooperating, and grandmother was just distraught. And the provider came in and said, Gary, I don't know what to do. And so I walked in with her. First of all, I had to give the disclaimer that I'm not a doctor, but we had a conversation there, and the two of them embraced. There were tears. And that young lady went and got the treatment that she was brought in for. And I knew at the moment, I knew right then, I said, I'm supposed to be here. I mean, this is where I'm supposed to be. I'm done. I'm done on the corporate hamster wheel. This is it. And so it has meant more to me to see the lives of our staff flourish in ways that they may not have had that opportunity before, and watch our patients and smile at our patients, even behind the mask, you know, they're smiling. You know, the ones that will, if you give them the opportunity to have a conversation with you. And those are the things that just make a difference to me. It's just important to me. And we don't have much in this life if we don't have those relationships that we build with human beings along the way.
So how do you create, and we were talking about this before we started recording, and this is one of those moments where Sheila's going to kick me under the virtual table. Because I never follow the order of questions we have, you know.
That's why we get along so well.
It's like this. Right. It's like this.
Yeah. How do you create the, and maybe you don't know, maybe it's just what happens, but how do you, Gary, create the circumstances by which a nurse practitioner can come to you as the COO at that point? So, you know, second or third in command, right? You know, of an organization, and be able to say to you, I don't know what to do. Because that doesn't happen all the time, right? That is indicative of a healthier environment than others, right? If someone can say, I just don't know what to do. How do you create that environment?
Well, back then it was, you know, the easiest thing back then was just to really kind of just be nice to people, be respectful to people. And at the time I was trying to build relationships with the people at our one downtown location. And I think a lot of it was just simply getting to know people and building relationships and establishing a level of trust. And you have to establish trust beyond just the fact that you want to be know, liked and trusted. You want to be able to be competent to help people through tough situations and you work through problems together. But I've always been one of the I joke about this, but I said, I've always been a very provider-friendly administrator. And I don't mean that to say that I do favoritism with providers, but I try to debunk the myth of the, and it's not necessarily a myth everywhere, but admin versus clinical. And I said, we're gonna always try to solve this. We may never solve it all the way, but my goal was to build those relationships with those providers because I know, and it's a tough job. They're all tough jobs, but I think that was part of it. And just sitting down and having had previous conversations with those providers, whether be one-on-one sessions or be it just in the huddles or coaching, not coaching, but meetings. I had a meeting this morning, as a matter of fact, with one of our leaders in behavioral health, who is a psychiatrist and great person, and has great insight, and one of the smartest people I know. But we haven't had a lot of sit down conversations because the work that this person does and my work don't necessarily lend itself to having those conversations on an ongoing basis. But I do know a little something about this particular person who is a pretty well-known commodity in this area for some of the work he's doing with collaborative care. But a lot of it was, I was curious to know that the perception of administration, really me as a CEO, and he and I have so much more in common than either one of us would have ever thought. And we both think the system needs a lot of work, but at the same time, we all know that we've got to function within the system, and how do we do it the best way? But I think having those conversations, those real conversations, those authentic conversations with people, when you're not in a hurry and you've carved out that time, so you're not just doing a drive-by with people, but you're sitting with people and getting to know them on a personal level, even if you only have a few minutes. And as a CEO, that's one of the things that I always try to encourage my peers to do, and I do work with CEOs at different places, is you got to take time. And you don't have time not to take time. You have to take time to get to know people on a more personal level, not personal like I'm coming to eat at your house, but more on a personal level, like, hey, what kind of pets do you like? What are your hobbies? What are some things that what's in your heart? What drives you to do what you do, or why do you do it? And just to really have those real conversations. So that I think that was the key there, Stephen, is really having those real conversations that we had built trust on a very relational level that she felt comfortable enough to come to me and say, hey, I need some help. And I don't want to let this person out of my exam room without getting this treatment because it could potentially be a life or death situation with this young lady.
Right.
And that's how it was done.
Wow. Have you noticed that there's been, I'm when I was coming up in the workforce from a very young age, you always organized your management, your middle management into two groups. One was here's the person that's gonna tell everybody what they want and you have to do it, and here's the person that's gonna work with you to get it done. So it's like a working manager versus someone who's just telling you what you have to do. Have we evolved any from that, or what does that look like now in the workplace?
Yeah, so I think there's still an evolution taking place with that, but I know that when I took over this health center back in 2014, we eliminated the word manager and management from all of our job descriptions, from all of our, really all of the any details and documentations we had, that word went away. I wanted to focus on leading people in directions that were, certainly. There's the old, you've seen the exercise, or I don't know if you've seen the video, but there's a string, and if you push it, it just crumbles up. But if you pull it, it comes along straight. And my theory and philosophy really always been, we can pull people along and share the vision with them and share what's in it for them. You're more apt to get people to want to, to do some of those things that align with your goals and objectives. And I do think we're at a place now, especially with the climate of today. And I always joke and say my CEO job has been harder these last 3 years than it ever was the first seven that I was doing this, because coming out of COVID in particular, it is a much, I would say it's a more fragile state in terms of how people perceive things and how and what people are, I guess, capable of managing and handling on their own. So leadership has become certainly become a much tougher ordeal, and it's a 24/7 commitment, really, if you are, depending on how high up you go. But there is, I don't necessarily believe there's two differentiating pillars on, leadership versus management. I think there's always leadership versus management, but I think that really those dynamics have much more blended now. And I think that we're having to look to see, how do we lead people? How do we bring people along to share a common vision with them? And how do we share with them what their work means to anything we're trying to accomplish? We did a CEO town hall the other day, and I encouraged everyone to say, if you don't know what our strategic plan is, go out and look at it. I said, it's out there. We share it all. We're very transparent. We share all the updates and everything, even to the point of talking about my succession planning. And when people read that, they're like, oh, I know. And they've read it because they ask questions. But if they haven't read it, then they go on, they go about their business. But I said, the question to really ask yourself is, what is my role in this? How does it impact me? And how do I, in my own work world, assure its success? And so those are the kind of things that I try to draw it down to an individual level, because if you think about it for a minute, you get to answer that question, those particular questions. You can really weave your own input and effort into most anything. And that is really what I try to invite people here to do. And anybody I'm working with, I try to invite them into a broader engagement conversation.
I think that the whole discourse on managers, the whole just the way we think about managers is shifting so much right now, because it is more and more clear to me after the huge churn that we saw in 2022, where 48 million people left their jobs that year. Most of them went and found another job, but the churn was 48 million strong. That organizations are going to live or die by their managers.
That's true.
And I think, and specifically the middle manager, typical sort of what we would attribute to that level, because one, it's such a tough position in general, because you've got the managing that you're doing while delivering to those quote unquote above you. But somehow we have decided that we are going to make managers out of excellent technicians and just throw them out to the wolves and say, you are great at what you do. Now manage everybody else who does this. And we have forgotten that, like, the glue of the daily operations of an organization is so often the manager, right? That whether or not they can hold that stuff together, is what makes productivity possible, is what makes any sort of value of culture and morale possible. And we just in this country do an awful job at helping people be good managers, right? It's something I'm trying to get my arms around on a daily basis, in terms of how we support our health centers, because we've got all these cool things that we're doing that we want to help them with. If they will live or die by the managers.
Yeah, but I think part of that too is knowing when someone shouldn't be a manager. Just because
100%.
they're good in the they're a good technician or they're a good administrator, what it maybe you and maybe they don't need to be a manager. I think sometimes, and I think it's ha and Gary, you can give us some insight too on this. I think now more so after COVID, because staffing levels are so low, that when someone gets a good employee that's good at the job that you hired them for, they automatically think, now we need to make them a manager. And then it totally destroys the morale, the productivity, because maybe that's not what they were meant to be. Maybe you need to figure out a way to reward them or do something other than turn them into a manager, because that's not what they're suited for.
Yep. Or maybe train them.
And sometimes, you know, I had, to your point earlier, Gary and Stephen, at my point in my career, I had to make the decision. I went from being like a senior, an owner of my own business, senior vice president and so on. I woke up one day and decided I don't want to be in charge anymore. That's just not what I want to do. I lost sight of the creativity that I used to do, all the fun stuff that I used to love. That's why I'm doing what I do. And decided, nope. And even as much as people want to push me back up that ladder to that CEO part, I'm like, no, I'm happy right here. But I had to go through all that to learn that this is where I'm happiest. And I wonder if there's a way to help people learn that about themselves, because I don't think everybody wants to be in management, I guess.
Well, yeah, that's a great point. You both make great points. And one of the things that, again, you have to work extra hard with that middle tier, because they're the ones that, you know, that really do catch it from both ends. And I'm working with a large health center out west, and we talk about their large middle management group that feels tugged from both ends. And when you expand out your management ranks or your leadership ranks, and you know, I can just speak to what we have at our health center here. You have to be intentional about, you have to have a list of competencies, you know, and we created some here before when we created our mid-level group. We call them associate directors, but when this group was sort of created to be the filter between the directors and then the leads and then maybe the regular staff, we wanted to make sure those associate directors, or ADs as we call them, had a very well-defined set of competencies and traits that we expected out of an associate director. Now, another expectation there is that, you know, we did, and I think I shared this with you all, we built our own leadership academy in-house, and there are courses that we assure that they go through. And we also have the DISC too. We put them through DISC. We want to make sure they understand where their strengths are and where there may be some opportunities, areas. And we try to work with them on that, because emotional intelligence is something that can be taught and learned. As long as you are taught it, you can learn it, because you don't know what you don't know. And so back to, again, Sheila, your point is that sometimes these folks are getting thrust into these positions without any real formal training, and think that, and there's a big difference in going from, you know, being a contributor where your peers are your friends or work friends to being, in many cases, their supervisors. And then the failure rate it tends to be much higher if there's not some very intentional training and development, coaching along the way, and just, you know, again, I use the word intentionality. It has to be very intentional, or you're going to have failure. And they have to be very transparent, because what I always encourage my ADs to do, and I meet with them 3 times a year, and with the goal for those meetings is to create those relationships between the 15 of, or so of them, and to also make sure they understand the strategic plan and the roles they play in them, and how they're supposed to communicate with across the groups what's happening at our health center. Because we don't want to get in a scenario to where a certain group feels like they're being left out, and then decisions are being made without them being included. And we still hear that kind of stuff, but I'm always able to point back and say, well, help me understand what wasn't communicated to you from this group over here, or do you get to look at the leadership slides that come out? And sometimes they say yes, sometimes they say no. One thing I do learn is that people have selective hearing and seeing in certain cases.
Right.
Right. But my thing I learned from a mentor back in the mid 2000s that says, listen, you can only mess up so much by giving everybody everything they need. And I'm like, okay. And he said, in other words, put it in their lap. And so one of the things I've always been very, I've emphasized to a high degree here at this health center, I said, over communicate, give the abundance of information, make sure everyone knows what's going on at our health center at all times. And I said, we will never everything we work on does roll up to our strategic priorities in our strategic plan. We won't deviate outside of that. We'll tie, you know, we may have to do a couple of projects here and there. I said, but by and large, everything we do is going to be tied to the plan in some way, shape, or form. That's why I try to educate every single person here how important their roles are to the plan itself and living out our mission, vision, and values. But that middle tier, very important. You have to pay special attention to them. You can't leave them out there all by themselves. And they need support because they tend to look at you and believe they've been abandoned at times.
I try my best to ask questions without telling a story, and I fail most of the time.
You're a good storyteller.
That's who you are, Stephen. You have to embrace who you are.
I know.
Right.
Yes, it is.
You can't fight it.
Just
you
what
can't
it
fight.
Is.
People That's are... why you're lucky. I'm a very patient person because I just sit here and listen.
Yes. Yeah. Well, hopefully you can multitask and get something done while I drone
I'm just
on and on.
Notes.
So I think one of the challenges in workforce is, and this goes well beyond health centers, but is there's a real allergy still to paying attention to personality mm-hmm. when we hire. And you know, a lot of employers got burned for a while for doing that, and for good reason, because they were using that as a proxy for bias and for, you know, racism and sexism, right? And you know, courts caught on and said, you know, stop doing that. Mm-hmm. But you can use personality to understand who you're hiring and their fit, right? Job fit, if you do it right. Mm-hmm. So I think about in my work the big five personality traits all the time, right? Like agreeableness and openness to experiences. And I hate this word, but it's what industrial psychologists like to use: level of neuroticism, right? How neurotic somebody is. And so you use that to be able to sort of figure out, right? Like if you have someone that is highly agreeable, that's just their personality, you are not going to hire them as an auditor because you want that person to be questioning of everything. They don't believe anything without a receipt, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have something that when you think about how you recruit
yes.
team members,
yes.
is there a core competency, a core personality skill that you think, I don't care what the job is, I want them to have X?
Well, and again, we don't use tests. I'm not a big believer in those tests, as you know. I don't think I've never been a proponent of those, but I'm a big proponent of the behavioral-based interviewing.
Yep.
And asking a good number of questions, but everything is centered around our core values. And so we really seek out examples in just the responses to the questions of how they're, you know, how they have performed in the past with a core value statement. I mean, the experience itself, we all get to pretty easily just by the resume itself. And then my interviewing and having the experts in the room interview the candidates, especially if they're clinical. But to be able to kind of read through some of the, you know, some of the verbiage that's on the resume in terms of how they're going to fit in your culture, you know, it's not 100%, but if you certainly can read the body language and look and see, you know, how the responses are in terms of the values themselves, then or what the past experiences have been, and, you know, just how you deal with certain situations, then, you know, if you can marry that up with the responses on the technical side, yes, I think in my mind, that's as good as measuring stick as you can have without doing a, and I don't even think the tests are that. I mean, you can certainly do the test, but you may disqualify someone who can function well. And like I use disc a lot. If somebody can function well in all four quadrants, but yet, stands out in the eye, they're not going to be that C person you just described as wants that receipt for everything.
Right.
Well, I can tell you, my shade drifts over into the C because, interestingly enough, as a CEO, I can't live in my eye all the time. I have to live in all four of them. I have to make some decisions that would land you square in the D. Your heart has to be out there for the S. And then, from a compliance and risk management viewpoint, you better have your I's dotted and your T's crossed. So I got to function over in that C. But if I just go by the test alone, I might not get hired for a position like this because, maybe my little circle needs to be closer to the middle, and I might get disqualified because it tends to be on the on the outer circle there. So, but I think if you do your interviewing, and if you have a very robust behavioral interview process, and you have multiple people doing the interview, so you got five or six people. We always do panel interviews, and then you tie it to your core values, and I think that's as good as you're going to get.
So when you do your panel interviews, is that with people specifically that they're going to be working with,
It's a
or?
mix. It's a mix. Yeah, it's a mix. And so, we've had our dental director interview nurse practitioners, and it's just, it just really kind of comes down to, and the reason we can do it that way is simply because of our values-oriented behavioral interview process. And we do have, certainly you have to have the people that they're going to be working with and working for as part of it as well. But we mix the room up pretty good, and we're just really looking to see is the person a core values fit. With the hygiene piece of it is you got to be able to know your work, and you got to have you got to be able to hit the credentials you have on that piece of paper. And that can be for anything. I mean, if I'm going to interview for a CEO job, I've got to be able to impress the board that I can have a degree of influence that's going to motivate and inspire my staff. But yet I better be able to have the experience behind it that says our health center's never been any issues with HRSA, and we weren't upside down financially.
Right.
So,
Right.
so those
He
are
had a
the,
great personality, but
yeah,
yeah.
but not so good as other stuff. We can have you be the greeter at the door.
Right.
I'd be good at that.
Well, and to your point though, I mean, I think there is a point with that last comment that like you, when you're hiring someone, no single element should be considered for yes, we're going to hire them, or should be considered for no, we don't want to hire them, right? That compensatory selection process, right? Where instead of, this is very technical, so everybody's about to take a nap, but you have multiple hurdle selection where if you don't hit each progressive hurdle, you're out, or you
I
have
feel like,
compensatory.
Stephen, I'm going to interrupt you for a sec. I feel like in it, I should be explaining this to the listener. Like, okay, so what he means by.
Well, I'm nerding out for 30 seconds, and then we'll get back to it. But you
We're
have
going to get back
multiple
to it.
selection and a compensatory selection where you take the full picture of the person, right? So if there are tons of people in the labor force who haven't actually interviewed for a job in 10 years, and you put them into an interview scenario, and no doubt they're going to be nervous. Right. And so how does that anxiety show in an interview? And they could have an awful interview, but be a great candidate.
It's true.
So when you take the full sort of picture of someone, I wonder just, because you're good at telling stories, do you have anybody that you've ever hired that has sort of surprised you? That like, huh.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Even either for good or bad, right? That like you didn't expect what you got out of them after that hiring process.
Well, the beauty of doing the kind of stuff we do is we're not perfect and we're going to make mistakes. And
Right.
I've had it on both ends. I've also, one of the things I believe to be probably better at than maybe I am in some other things is to be able to see that unleashing of potential if given the right opportunity. And we have internal, like you typically see candidates' internal blow interviews that are better than that. They get nervous for whatever reason, and then you have to kind of give them, to decide if you're going to give grace or not, depending on their, their technical capabilities, and would you want to take a chance at, on them in a certain role. But I know we have one person in particular here right now who has moved up the chart pretty well and is doing some really important and critical things at our health center that was on a performance improvement plan several years back and was on our way out the door, but was just in the wrong position. And so we had a lot of conversation, and I kind of, and again, as a CEO, you don't have to step into these things too much, but this is probably 5 years ago. We were a little smaller then, and I remember learning of the fact that this person was probably on the way out, and I'm like, wait a minute, no. I said, we have we I said, I've seen this person in action. I feel like I know the traits and the capabilities and what this person brings to the table. And so we were successfully able to move that person into another role that complemented her skills. And now, I mean, now she's helping us with revenue management. She's helping driving spirit team activities here, which keep people pumped up all the time. And she's a hustler. She's just a hard worker. She's all over the place. Helps our providers with our coding. I mean, she's a rock star, but she was that close to being out of here. And sometimes it takes. And if and I'm hopeful that if it's not me that sees it, somebody else sees it. But that's why it's so important as a team. Sometimes you have to kind of think more broadly. Now, that was just one example. But we've certainly hired some people that I can't think of in particular. I can think of one particular person we hired that really had a great interview, but just couldn't deliver. And we were just like, well, that's why I said earlier, you can't be perfect. You really have to. The way I look at workforce internal to an organization, when I do my consulting and my coaching, I say the same thing. Have a very well written progressive discipline plan, number one, but have a very well written core values, set of core values that you use, tied to everything you're doing, and then. And document the things that are either working well or not working well. And when you and don't spend a lot of time in scenarios that aren't going to work out. Try to get to a scenario where you're coaching and you're improving and you're doing all the right things to help the person improve. And then if that person may not be the fit for that, is there another position at your health center that person could be a fit for? Because we all know how difficult it is to find people now. And so that's one of the things that I've really tried to encourage here. It is to, hey, don't just throw the old saying is don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And the thing here is let's look and see, can the person fit somewhere else? Is there an opportunity? So we look at a lot of different things. We don't just not just closed off to they're going to fail here or they're going to succeed here and that's it. So I think that's probably the biggest thing is that there's people out there that that may need an opportunity. You may not give it to them just based on what you see in your first experience. And I would just say dive deep into that and make sure.
That intervention component is so critical, and at what point it happens, right? When you see someone starting to drown, right? That if you can intervene at the right point to say like nope, let's shift gears and approach this. I would imagine the person that you talked about in your example a couple moments ago probably has a level of loyalty to your organization that is unmatched by most others there, right? Because as much as you and other managers were seeing that this wasn't the right fit, she clearly knew that too, right? She may not talk about it, admit it, but she went home saying like, this is just not working. And for an employer to say like, we want this to work, so let's figure out what that looks like. I mean, when we talk about engagement and buy-in, we can do all these well-branded, sorry, Sheila, well-branded strategies, right? That look pretty but like that authentic engagement and buy-in, you can't buy it for one. But like that's the kind of loyalty. This sort of transitions into to I want to see just sort of out in the field your take on this. But when we talk and complain about Gen Z and millennials, I'm a millennial, so I get to be part of that group that talks bad about us. That's the kind of stuff that like that we are hungry for, right? That we're craving is that those authentic moments of connection. Are you seeing that as well with that age group within the workforce?
Yes, and I think it's funny. I got a text from somebody totally outside of the healthcare profession asking me that exact same question, but doesn't have the same level of patience and awareness to not get frustrated with some of the things that they see with the younger workforce. And you know, my explanation back, I said, you just be patient and listen. And but at the same time, help them. It's very important to help them understand the why of the bigger picture. And I think that is probably more critical now than it's ever been, is you got to get to the why in just about everything you do and everything you decide and almost everything you say that may contradict somebody else. Because, I mean, you know, we live in this crazy divisive society now, which is just so unfortunate. And again, I always, you know, as I look at the social media, that doesn't help us with any of that stuff. But when I think about as leaders, you know, if we are able to have that authentic conversation and talk about the why, when we have to give them news they don't want to get or help them understand something that they may be pushing back on, it's just if the authentic conversation and the listening and the why and showing you're interested in them goes a very long way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I kind of give it a sports analogy now. I mean, you see it in the, at least in college sports, the portal has probably opened the eyes to a lot of coaches in that sense, because these younger athletes are just not, they're not going to not play. They're not going to not stand there and want to be yelled at. It's a whole different world for them. And you see a lot of those coaches that were in the, you do what I tell you to do when I tell you to do it, are all leaving the ranks now because it's a whole new world. You have to build those relationships to keep the players. And I kind of see that correlation with the younger generations coming in, that you have to build you're building your team around their abilities, but you also have to know how to communicate that.
Yes,
so to speak.
You know, I see that there's a double-edged sword with that, and I do see that you have to lead differently, no question. The interesting analogy of the portal is what we see in the workforce a lot. You see a lot of these folks come in, they don't stay long, they leave, because it goes back to, I don't think they've had the exposure to what sometimes it comes into. Oh my gosh, the real world. This is the real world. Hit me right in the face, and I don't like this. I don't like this part of it. I don't like this manager or this leader. I'm going to go work over here. And a lot of this is when they get to the next place they're going, it's leaping from the fry, you know, the frying pan to the fire. But that's part of what we're seeing today. I mean, that is just what we have to embrace. That is that's the reality, is that, so we, you know, we have to do a combination of things. We have to listen differently. We have to help encourage them and not get frustrated there, you know, try to pull the best out, unleash the potential, help them understand the benefits of the hard work and why that, we want to do the, you know, I see all these things about the 32-hour work week and the 36-hour work week and the different things like that. But the reality of it is work's got to be done. People still want to be paid. And customers want the service. Patients want to be seen. So, and we already have workforce shortages it is. So it's interesting to see what, you know, how this all plays out. But I think, you know, if you wipe all that stuff off the table and you create a meaningful experience for the people that come in and you know, and do work for your health center or your company, whatever it is, and you try to make it more than just about the work, and you help them understand that you're investing in yourself as well. And everybody comes out with a bit of a win-win. Hard work, be honest with them, but you know, I think that's part of the education process. And you know, we were all young at one point in time. I had my own ideals back then, and you know, I was probably, I'd have fired myself when I was 22 years old.
I laugh because it's the like Steven said earlier, the version of me,
Oh
20, 30 years ago is definitely not the version of me
my God.
today, for sure.
And you know what? It shouldn't be, right? Like,
No, that's true. No. You
thank
should
goodness for
grow and
growth.
develop.
Hey, So
team.
I know we're running out of time, and that's every podcast says that when they're trying to stay, right? Like we
Yeah.
just really are running
We
out of
could
time.
talk
But
forever. I
well,
do have a
yes.
hard
See,
stop too.
Gary, you were in the realm of his sweet spot of workforce of HR. So, yes, he could keep
But
you on forever.
I'm wondering, so you are a serial entrepreneur, Gary, and one of the way we have come to know you is through Impact to Lead and the work that you're doing with, is consulting fair enough of a word? I mean,
Yes.
So anything that you're seeing in that world of consulting that are trends that you're picking up on that or I don't know, tidbits that you're like, well, everybody is going through this,
Yeah.
or wow, I wish everybody was doing this. What are you seeing?
Well, I get to work with new CEOs a lot, which, they're coming in. So if I'm looking at it from that perspective, from an executive coaching perspective and kind of helping them through their own planning, a lot of it is just sort of the deer in the headlights. When you jump on a CEO role, for example, or any new role that's kind of it's a step in a different direction, that the you learn a lot as you go. So a lot of that is just, be prepared to these folks are coming in, and you don't know what you don't know until you get in. It's trying to prepare yourself for what you don't know. What I see just in general as a thin as a trend is a lot of what we're talking about is how do we improve our workplace culture? How do we do some things that are gonna align ourselves in a lot of workplace and a work culture with our value system, our mission, our vision, our strategic plan. It's really trying to bring alignment together. Recruitment and retention is a big thing. It's everywhere. And my role in going into various places is to again, when I do executive coaching or any kind of leadership coaching, it's to help them be a more approachable leader, to help them, to be able to, certainly lead other people and try to unleash that their potential in the people that they work with, and to help them be more strategic as well. And when I go to work for just companies and trying to help with just workforce things, a lot of it is just around culture work with their own team development and helping them draft plans that are human centric. And so when there was a Deloitte back in the Human Capital Trends in 2021 that came out, that and their bold statement was every decision that will be made going forward will have a human element baked into it. And so that's really kind of where it is. And so that's pretty much the common trend. So you are in a good space where you set to help health centers out. And I think that's what I would just suggest to everyone is that, get your culture right. Certainly try to differentiate yourselves in how you serve people. And do your best to recruit and retain in an environment that is as challenging as it's ever been. But you got to prepare your leaders to be able to handle it, and make sure your personal brand aligns with your organization's brand.